All right, let's start. So welcome, everyone. Oh, that light is bright. Let's welcome everybody to the inequality seminar with Sarah Goff today, talking about the stakes of trade policy, global and domestic inequalities. But before we start, I have a couple of announcements to make, for this is a very busy week at LSE with the LSE Festival Beverage 2.0 going on. So I wanted to point your point you in the direction of a couple of events that involve people from our institute. So tonight, there's going to be a panel discussion on the challenges of richness, rethinking the giant of poverty, with our institute's Mike Savage and Luna Glucksberg, also Tanya Buchart from the Social Policy Department, Sam Friedman from Sociology, and London-based artist Amy Fennec. That's from 8 to 9 tonight in the Sheikh Zayed Theater. Tomorrow night from 7 to 8 p.m. In the Wolfson Theater, it's going to be a very interesting panel on writing fiction to dramatize inequality, and that features our institute's Nikki Lacey and award-winning authors Winnie Lee and Louise Doughty, and it's chaired by Bingjun Meng. No night off this week, because Friday night, 6:30 from 7 to 7:30 at that Sheikh Zayed Theater, there's a panel on the lessons from Grenfell Tower, inequality in housing needs, the giant that still divides us, which is chaired by our institute's own John Hills, and it features Ann Power from the Social Policy Department, author Lindsay Hanley, and Danny Dorling from Oxford University. Last but not least, on Saturday from 3:15 to 4:30 at the Alumni Theater, there's going to be a panel called The Five LSE Giants' Perspective on Poverty, featuring the enormous John Hills, Tanya Buchart, Stephen Jenkins, Lucinda Platt, and Paul Gregg. And this is only a selection, actually. There's a lot more events, so please go to our website if you want to see the full listing of Beverage Festival events. So our regular inequality seminars continues on March 6th, same time and place, when Abigail McKnight, Polly Vizard, and Pedro Mendez Lureiru will present their project on developing a capability-based inequality framework. Let that sink in. So on to today's talk. Title is here on the screen. Very, very happy to be able to announce Sarah Goff to give her talk today. She'll talk for about 45 minutes, and then it'll be 30 minutes for Q&A. So floor is all yours.
Thanks very much. I'm a political theorist in the government department, and as such, I think my probably approach and the questions I'll be asking might be slightly different from what's usually the format for this seminar. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to get straight into the kind of questions that I'll be asking and trying to answer in this presentation. And when I propose the ways that this presentation and the corresponding article try to answer them, I'll say a bit about what I think political theory has to contribute to discussions about what a good trade deal consists in, which is the primary question of this talk. So recently, just in the past couple of years, particularly in Britain as well as in the US, there has been this quest for better trade deals, which has really motivated a lot of recent political events as well as discourse about where Britain as well as the US is going in the future. So I've got some quotes that I think illuminate the problem of defining and understanding what a better trade deal consists in. So here we have Donald Trump, who won in part because he employed very effective political rhetoric criticizing President Obama as well as President Clinton for their efforts to forge trade deals that would benefit America. So here's Trump on NAFTA. He said much nastier things about NAFTA, but here's a kind of clean quote from him about that. NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. That's a strong criticism of President Clinton, and therefore also Hillary Clinton at the time. And here's what he promised to do better as president. We will negotiate fair bilateral trade deals that will bring jobs and industry back onto American shores. So the question is, what is a fair or a better bilateral trade deal? What does that consist in? Is it just this kind of empty, maybe ill-informed rhetoric, or is there a good idea behind it that we can specify? Similarly, David Davis on Brexit employed, I suggest, this idea of a better fair trade deal in some of the early rhetoric in support of the Leave campaign. We, meaning Britain, upon leaving the EU, would be able to negotiate our own trade deals, opening up new markets. The difference here depends most upon exactly what we choose to do with the country and its newfound freedoms. The greatest improvements will come if we grasp the opportunities for free trade with both hands. So the suggestion, which will seem counterintuitive, is that by leaving the EU, the UK could forge its own path towards freer, better trade deals. So there's a question then of what that consists in and whether, of course, that's really likely to happen. So to understand these promises and these criticisms, I suggest that we should think back to the context of the last 20 or 30 years on trade, which has been really marked by the decline of multilateralism as well as mega-regionalism. By mega-regionalism, I'm referring most prominently to the EU, but also to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was meant to be Obama's legacy, but Trump has pulled the U.S. out of that. So notably, the Doha development round at the World Trade Organization has collapsed. So that's since 2001, there's been no progress at all on multilateral trade liberalization. And that's I think, really quite significant for understanding why there's been a proliferation of interest in regional trade agreements as well, notably in preferential and bilateral trade agreements. So as I mentioned earlier, President Trump has sought to undo Obama's legacy signature achievement on trade, which was to put forward and make the U.S. a leader in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'm just going to give you, I'm going to skip ahead now to show you just the broader context. So it's not really just about the UK and the US. There's been a much broader proliferation of preferential trade agreements over the last 30 years. And 1990 is a clear turning point. And it's not just between developing and developed countries. Very notably, there's a huge increase in preferential trade agreements among poor countries. Okay, so what is the current debate about trade deals, and how can we do better? I think there is this odd arrangement of the left and right in allying against free trade. And I think because trade agreements are not currently well situated for conflict between parties or between the left and right, there's this confusion and a lack of discourse about what a better trade deal actually consists in. So here we have on the left, we have Bernie Sanders and we have Elizabeth Warren, prominent economic leftists in the US, who came out very strongly in criticism of President Obama's efforts to include the US in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Elizabeth Warren, in particular, was very critical that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was going to be a gift to big business and was not going to further the interests of American workers. So from her standpoint, the economic gains that were likely to accrue to the US were not important because those gains were not going to be directed towards the right people. Similarly, also, we have Jeremy Corbyn, who's not really said as much as many think he ought to in opposing what's been referred to as a hard Brexit. So there seems to be at least some ambivalence, if not some outright opposition, from those on the left towards the question of trade liberalization. And of course, we have on the right some Brexiteers, as well as this kind of strange alliance between Trump and May. So that's to say, I think we have this strange circumstance where left-right divides don't tell us as much as they could about the significance of trade, and we don't have a well-structured political debate about it. So from my standpoint, what's useful about having a presentation to the Inequalities Institute is that I can just assume that we care about inequalities. Very nice. So I think there are three relevant domains of equality, and I'm going to give the most attention to the first, which is domestic inequality. And that's basically the question of what this better trade deal consists in. The usual way of talking about it is purely in economic terms. There are special interest groups or disadvantaged groups who would benefit maybe economically from greater protectionism or maintaining protectionism. And against those groups, there's the economic well-being of the country as a whole. My suggestion will be that this is not the right framework to think about the question or the idea of a better trade deal. And instead, we ought to think of a conflict between economic and non-economic values, particularly the value of a country's policy space. So that's going to be the main thesis of this presentation, and I'm going to give a few different areas of trade policy to illustrate this conflict, but we'll get to that. I think there are also at stake important issues in the in the global context with respect to inequalities. Now, there are principles of global procedural fairness in the way the World Trade Organization is organized, and those principles are reciprocity and non-discrimination. We don't talk about them very much because for the UK, and for the most part for the US, the WTO hasn't had as much significance in our political discourse because not a lot of activity has taken place since 2001. But if there is, in fact, a reversion to WTO rules to govern how the UK engages in trade with the EU as well as with non-EU countries, these rules and principles are going to become more significant. And I'll say a bit about their significance even now. And finally, there's the question of global distributive inequality. And I want to be clear about what the problem is here. So there are many people who think that there is excessive attention to trying to get developing countries and poor countries to liberalize their own barriers to trade. What I'm referring to is the retention of barriers to trade on the part of rich countries against poor countries. And a lot of people who are worried, particularly economists, that the decline of multilateralism means essentially a loss of progress in terms of opening up the markets of rich countries to poor countries, and therefore the loss of opportunities to reduce poverty. And that's what I'm interested in as well. Okay, so on to the first of those three domains of inequality, domestic inequality. So I think the economic gains from trade from the perspective of a rich country like the US, like the UK, is very familiar and well known to us. There are economic gains that accrue to the country as a whole when there is trade liberalization. And to understand what those are, you add up the gains to consumers from lower prices, the gains to firms from lower prices for their inputs, and gains to firms through the expansion of the volume of production through their greater access to foreign markets. So here's where I think there needs to be a greater accounting of the costs of participation in trade agreements. This is the contribution or the idea of the presentation, which is that we have to understand the non-economic value of participation in a trade agreement, which is the cost to policy space. So there's a trade-off between the economic gains from trade and the value of a country's policy space, which is to say that the country can no longer set policies in certain domains because it's made legal commitments not to make certain choices. So what I'll argue is that policy space is particularly valuable when it's essential for a society to perform certain core functions of competency and to maintain its inclusiveness. And I'll try to illustrate these ideas with a few different areas of trade policy. So when a country participates in a trade agreement, it agrees to forego certain policy options. Most obviously, It agrees and makes binding commitments not to impose tariffs or quotas on exports from other countries. So that's policy space that's been lost. And there's a clear benefit, which is the prospect of gains in national income. This idea can be expanded more generally to encompass regulatory harmonization on lots of other issues as well. So when a country agrees to forego border checks by participating in a larger free trade area, such as the common market or the single market, they are foregoing their policy space on these same issues. So just to say a little bit about this with respect to the EU requires a significant contribution of policy space on the part of all of its members. In return, there are pretty significant economic gains. So simply by foregoing checks at the border, it's been estimated that the costs of trade are at, what's at stake in that is 3.5% of the cost of trade. So assuming full regulatory compliance, no actual tariffs, all you need to do is have border checks, that will increase the cost of trade significantly. And that seems like that's a bad deal. You've lost or you've gained nothing in policy space if you have full regulatory compliance, and you've lost something of economic value. And that's essentially the Norway-style agreement that's being proposed, that there would be full regulatory compliance but border checks. And my proposal is that's a pretty bad deal relative to the status quo, because you've gained nothing in terms of valuable policy space, and you've lost something of economic value. Okay, so I'll try to illustrate this idea now with respect to a few areas. The first I think is pretty important is agriculture. So upon leaving the EU, the UK will gain a lot of policy space in agriculture if no bespoke deal is forged with the EU. So the UK will no longer be part of the single market and customs union. It will no longer be bound to participate in the common agricultural policy, which includes a schedule of agricultural subsidies and regulations. And it will also no longer be part of the generalized system of preferences, which is how the EU gives unilateral privileges to particular poor and developing countries to allow their agricultural products to enter more or less duty-free into the EU. I think this is pretty important from a distributional perspective, particularly because the poorest households in the UK spend quite a lot of their budgets on food, and the UK is a net food importer. So from the perspective of worrying about distributional inequalities within the country, I think the economic gains or the prospective economic losses are pretty significant. The usual way of thinking about this is to look at the economic interests of farmers, domestic farmers, the agricultural industry, and to compare those to the prospective gains to the country as a whole. I'm going to propose that that's inadequate, because instead we need to look at the value of the policy space. So here's where things maybe get a little weird, and we realize just how much policy space is really at stake in the UK's current arrangements with the EU. So the proposal, which I've called weird, is from a group called Economists for Brexit, which are now called Economists for Free Trade, who proposed that the UK could simply unilaterally liberalize. So if the EU refuses to forge a free trade agreement on good terms for the UK, the best option for the country is just to unilaterally drop all of its restrictions on imported food from other countries. So that's a weird policy. It's a weird proposal. But it's interesting that we could now do that, or we could do that upon leaving the EU. And that certainly was not, it is not an option in the status quo. So I think it's interesting because it's kind of true that the EU has significant barriers to trade with non-EU countries with respect to food. So there's a lot of potential gains for liberalization, specifically in agriculture. And the economists for free trade or Brexit are proposing that this would allow a lot of the accurately forecasted losses from trade with the EU to be wiped out through gains with trade with other countries. So my suggestion is that, well, thinking about this purely in economic terms is inadequate. The question instead is it required for a country to be competent that it grows a significant amount of its own food or not? That's, I think, a difficult, arguable question, but I think that's the right terms of debate. And my suggestion is that it's probably not important, that it would be okay for a country to import maybe all of its food, and that really is the scenario that we're talking about if there was unilateral trade liberalization. Others will disagree on that, but that's really the right terms of debate rather than thinking about it purely in economic terms. That was very brief, and you're welcome to come back with questions about that later. But I'm going to continue my sketch of several different policy areas. So another important policy area is manufacturing. This is another industry that could prospectively be wiped out in the scenario of no deal with the EU. So a kind of mercantilist logic where each country is interested in increasing exports and diminishing its imports to the greatest extent possible has this kind of logic. I'll grant your manufacturers access to my market only if my country's manufacturers have access to your market, this kind of tit-for-tat form of reciprocity that actually governs much of trade negotiations. Manufacturing matters a lot politically. It certainly matters to, I think, explain Trump's victory in the U.S. There's a great symbolic value to manufacturing jobs because they're good jobs. They're thought to represent middle-class status. And I think it's significant that what a state gives up in its trade agreement, it is in a liberalizing trade agreement, is its permission to protect these jobs. So there's a loss of policy space to protect an industry that has economic as well as symbolic value for the rest of the country. My suggestion is that this is really a more general dilemma of domestic inequality, which is how much in terms of economic well-being for the whole country is a society willing or ought to be willing to give up in order to protect certain important middle-class jobs that also have symbolic value for everyone. Is it really essential for an inclusive society to maintain workers and good jobs? And here I have I've borrowed somebody else's graph indicating that in manufacturing, productivity has increased a lot, but employment has stayed stable and even started declining a little bit. So ultimately, the cost of preserving each one of these manufacturing jobs is high and only going to increase. But there's just a question of whether a society, particularly a wealthy society, ought to be prepared to pay that. And maybe the answer is yes, maybe the answer is no, but that's the right terms of debate for this question. Finally, also very briefly, there's an important debate which is starting to be had about product regulation and working standards. So if the UK leaves the EU in a hard Brexit scenario, it will no longer be bound by regulations on working time as well as gender equality. And there's a question about how much that's going to cost. The hard Brexiteers who want to argue that the economic costs will be low are going to say that there are significant gains from deregulation. A race to the bottom is to the benefit of those who are willing to drop their standards to the bottom level. And the cost is just the loss of trade with the EU due to the lack of regulatory harmonization minus the prospective gains from deregulation. And we can debate the relative magnitude of those two values. So, of course, there are strong objections to races to the bottom in general. Very prominently, there's been accusations about what would happen if the UK were to trade much more with the US, which has much laxer regulations on product safety, as well, arguably, with respect to working standards, and chlorine chicken, which is the washing of dead chickens with chlorine, which is an agricultural practice in the U.S., would be something that the U.K. would then have to accept as part of its food stream, which is worrying to some, but not to others. So what I think this illustrates is that the value of particular forms of policy space is greater the sharper the deviation from the normal legislative process. So if we think that Britain would usually, maybe if left to its own devices, accept chlorine chicken, having to continue accepting EU regulations with respect to product standards is going to be a bigger loss. It's going to be a bigger loss with policy space. If, on the other hand, we think maybe British consumers are really suspicious about chlorine chicken, then the deviation or the difference between the normal legislative process and participation in EU product standards is not quite so great. So I'm going to pause here to just restate the value of domestic inequality, or the value of, or the dilemmas of domestic inequality following this framework. The question that I think we ought to be asking, the political debate that we're not having but we ought to have, is as follows. What is the value of gains in GDP or economic growth for a society that's already pretty well off? How important is it to make sure that consumers don't have to pay more for their weekly food budget or grocery budget? How important is it that we can have an efficient economy, which may or may not include manufacturing? How important is it to just have growth? I think, interestingly, the odd bedfellows can be explained in part due to their similar answer to this question. So arguably, a lot of the hard Brexiters are not confronting this question because they want to eat their cake and have it too. But they might also think maybe economic growth is not maybe so important as having greater policy space. It's important to have the ability for a country to determine its own regulatory standards, they might think. It's important to have sovereignty over agricultural product policy, and so on. I think there's an interesting story to be told about why the economic left is maybe not so concerned about trade liberalization. And the story is that growth doesn't seem to benefit the groups that ought to be benefited by it, which is the poor, the working classes, and the middle classes. This is Elizabeth Warren's objection to trade liberalization under the Obama administration. The proposal for the Trans-Pacific Partnership was going to create economic gains, but they were more likely to be enjoyed by big business than the constituencies that she cared about. So the problem of domestic inequality is that not everyone shares in the benefits of trade liberalization. And finally, on the other hand, how much does it matter to retain discretion over particular policies? And that just depends on what you think the right answer ought to be about these different policy areas. Whether you think it's important for a country to grow its own food, whether you think it's important for a society to preserve certain valuable middle-class jobs, and whether you think it's important for a society to have discretion over product standards and workers' rights. Okay, so now we're going to move on to discuss the two other dimensions of inequality that I think are also important, which are global procedural fairness and global distributional inequality. And we're going to talk about preferential trade agreements as well as unilateral liberalization. So I had a graph earlier that showed the growth in bilateral trade agreements. Sorry, this is difficult to see, but what it is telling us is that for preferential trade agreements, they have more and more provisions incorporated into them concerning labor, the environment, investment standards, intellectual property rights, and so on. So there's more and more agreement on regulation. There's more and more policy space that is being incorporated into preferential trade agreements. Unilateral, go ahead.
For the environmental and labor ones, are they systematically sort of protecting environmental concerns and labor rights, or systematically protecting firms from domestic regulations that would protect environmental and labor rights?
I think it's a mix, actually. That's a good question. So is this to describing a race to the bottom for us, or is it describing setting minimal floors for standards? I think it's both. The point I was trying to make was that policy space is being lost for at least one part of one participant in a trade agreement on these issues. Okay, so I'll say a little bit more now about the proposal for unilateral liberalization and why the WTO's principles of procedural fairness may be binding us even now. So the proposal from the economists for Brexit is that the UK should unilaterally reduce all its barriers to trade without reciprocity from its trading partners. And there are different estimates about what would occur in terms of the economic benefits of doing so. They have estimated that this unilateral action would increase GDP by 4%, that is improvement over the status quo. Others, I think more sober estimates are that it's more likely to be not 0.3%. But what I think is interesting is that there really isn't the option that is both feasible and would produce economic gains, which is not unilateral liberalization across the board, but picking and choosing trading partners with which to unilaterally liberalize. And the reason that's not possible is due to the WTO's rule of non-discrimination. So this is an option that's politically off the table and reduces the alternative or the desirability of an alternative to the best negotiated agreement with the EU. So that's to say the WTO's rules of procedural fairness are binding now on what the UK can do when it's imagining scenarios post-Brexit. Okay, and so let me just describe briefly these principles now. We just lost the light, unfortunately, but here we have it. The principles are reciprocity and non-discrimination. And what reciprocity consists in is I reduce my barriers to trade, you do the same to the same degree, and we measure this purely in economic costs. And I'm unable to discriminate among prospective trading partners. So if I reduce my barriers to trade to one country or to a group of countries, I can't then refuse to do the same to other members of the WTO without doing it in the context of a trade agreement. Now, what I want to say is that the value of these rules is very limited. What it's limited to is reducing the arbitrary use of power. And the reason it's limited is that already there is widespread breach of these rules in order to try to improve the prospects for poor and developing countries that are currently not treated very well within the WTO and do not have negotiating power to try to open rich country markets. So the way out of these principles of non-discrimination and reciprocity is an allowance for special and differential treatment for poor and developing countries, which allows unilateral liberalization with poor and developing countries, and that's what we have for the US as well as the EU. And the question that we have is, will these unilateral forms of liberalization continue? What will the UK do if it now has to decide for itself how to have trade agreements with poor and developing countries? So the EU's generalized system of preferences, particularly the everything but arms scheme for the least developed countries, represents unilateral liberalization. There's a non-reciprocal agreement to allow imports from poor and developing countries, particularly with food, but for other products as well. And this is thought to be okay. It's a violation of rules of procedural fairness in the WTO, but it's thought to be okay because of the greater importance of allowing greater prospects for growth and development for countries that are already very poor. And that seems right to me. It seems that global procedural fairness is not so important as to disallow these kinds of measures. So here's the risk, though. The risk is if a relatively wealthy, powerful country gets to decide for itself, its trading partners, and to what degree to which it will liberalize trade, there is greater scope for the arbitrary use of power. Non-trade issues can be brought in, political alliances, and so on, maybe important considerations. And what I want to say is it's kind of interesting that the UK will find itself in this position of scrambling for new trading partners if it no longer has the same privileges that it used to have as being part of the EU. So oddly, this problem of the imbalance of power that I've referred to may no longer be an issue. And in that case, maybe we shouldn't worry so much about global procedural fairness after all. Okay, so finally, and I think most importantly, because it's most likely to be overlooked, there's quite a lot at stake in terms of global distributional inequality. So this is just considering the perspective of the EU and poor and developing countries that export a lot to it. So this is the UK currently, as part of the EU, has these countries that export a lot to it, and there's a question of whether these countries are going to retain their preferential access to British markets after Brexit. So for these countries, there's a lot at stake. They ought to be nervous. And particularly they ought to be nervous because the UK doesn't seem to have a lot of administrative capacity to forge new trade agreements. These countries are not likely to be high on their list of priorities, so they may well be excluded from the benefits of trade in the future. There is room for improvement. With a fully functional administrative capacity, if there were trade negotiators in full force with a high degree of competence, the UK could do a lot more to liberalize with poor and developing countries than it currently does as part of the EU. Because the EU's generalized system of preferences only goes so far, because the customs union retains high barriers to trade with respect to a lot of products that are important to poor and developing countries, there is genuinely room for improvement. Is that likely to happen? I've suggested probably not. But I think it's worthwhile to note that the increase in policy space that would come from British control over its trade policy at least allows for that possibility. And I think there are important questions about how to prioritize different prospective trading partners. I think there are questions to be asked about whether human rights conditionality or democracy or conditionality with respect to democracy is appropriate. The US does a lot specifically with respect to democracy. Workers' rights are also an important issue. And I think if we care about global distributional inequality, my suggestion is that we ought to care about how countries are governed and how they protect workers and vulnerable people within their own borders. Finally, I know I should close soon. I want to acknowledge that we are well in the realm of non-ideal theory. So any kind of bilateral or unilateral liberalization measures are going to be inferior to the first best solution, which is liberalization through multilateral forums, both because they're more efficient, but they'd also allow greater procedural say and voice to poor and developing countries. But nevertheless, it's important to think about second best solutions because we're certainly in a second best world at the moment. Okay, so I'm just going to skip ahead to the end. My main claims are that we have big questions about what a better trade deal would look like from the perspective of a relatively wealthy society like Britain, like the US. And I think we ought to think about this question in terms of the value of policy space against the value of economic growth or gains in national income. I think there are also important questions about how relatively wealthy societies should use their power to forge agreements with weaker parties through either unilateral liberalization or bilateral liberalization. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of possibly the most important domain of inequality of all, which is global distributional inequality. So thanks a lot.
Okay, let's open it up for questions. Right here.
Are there others? I mean,
oh, please go ahead.
Okay. This may be too small a part of what constitutes a policy space, so you might want to dismiss it. But what I find interesting is that not only can you put numbers on economic benefits and costs and opportunity costs, but that you can cost policy space.
Yeah.
All right. So if we then accept that, then what I miss in this is a geopolitical aspect, even though you've touched in various ways around it, and that is a great deal of money is spent on what one might call defense or protection, whether it's going to be terrorist threats or the security situation, and how is one going to cost and factor that in to this policy space? And if you've thought about that, I would be interested to hear about that.
That's really helpful. So I think national security is probably a great contender for being a core competency of a society.
Yes, that's why I've chosen it.
Yeah, thank you. And the concern is that it's used very casually to justify policies. I mean, certainly Trump references national security sort of indiscriminately to justify whichever policy choice he wishes to make. And I think why it's so effective as a move is both because it's kind of obviously a core competency, but also when we do a cost accounting for national security, it seems that the willingness to pay should be very high. So what this suggests is that if international cooperation to improve national security is at stake, quite a lot of economic gains could or ought to be sacrificed in order to have this core competency preserved. I think that's the right framework for thinking about it. I haven't proposed a solution for how that debate ought to happen, but I think it's certainly relevant because the scope of trade is so big that it certainly can't be excluded as an irrelevant factor. So I don't think it's a small question. My suggestion is that that's the right debate to be having.
Mm-hmm. And it also happens to be true, if I might add, between Brexit and the EU, what is going to be the security cooperation between, quote, the UK and the EU.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And these are, as you've noted, very interlinked issues. The worry from global procedural fairness constraints is that when something like this is at stake, there could be threats on one side or the other. I know that Theresa May has suggested that Britain's willingness to cooperate by turning over important classified information or would be made conditional on the amount of trade liberalization.
I really enjoyed that, and it brought up a lot of issues I think would be really interesting to like development economists as well, or at least just our development students, and especially the stuff around Britain forgetting about the preferential trade agreement with like the Gambia. I thought that was really, really interesting. But I had kind of just two questions, and it might just be that I didn't follow your kind of specifications enough. The first is when you assume first best, and you kind of tacitly say, oh, like, that would be best, but we're in a kind of second best reality. Like, are you assuming Pareto optimum? Because that would seem to be making huge assumptions that, based on the rest of your analysis, don't really hold. And then secondly, have you thought at all about kind of turning your considered and moderate thoughtful analysis towards analyses of kind of the positive externalities versus negative externalities of certain industries, specifically farming? That would be interesting to look at. Because there are obvious questions like benefits of inclusiveness, but then some people say that actually industrial farming isn't that harmful? So that would be really interesting.
Thanks a lot. I'm interested in this. I think probably the agricultural liberalization is the primary target for these concerns about development. And I would like to think more about this. So I've done kind of a brief sketch of what the framework suggests about these different policy areas. I mean, some people think that agricultural liberalization has the potential for win-win-win because we're in such a suboptimal arrangement, both in the perspective of Pareto optimality, but also in terms of political bargaining and concessions and compromises that have been made. So there are certainly development economists who think that if only there could be significant liberalization in agriculture on the part of rich countries, there would be great potential for developing countries to grow more and to grow more of their own food for export. Others think actually the subsidization of agriculture that takes place in America as well as in Europe is often very useful because it reduces the price of food, which is globally, which is good for the really destitute in cities worldwide. So I'd like to learn a bit more about that. I do think it's probably quite contentious, and how you read the empirical literature on that will make a big difference to your theoretical analysis and your ethical analysis of what ought to happen. But I think it's really interesting that now these questions now we're presented with these questions. Because there's so much potential flux and change in these policies.
Thanks. So kind of touching on my first point, touching on something you just said about the different estimates of who gains from various things. So I'm an economist. And perhaps unsurprisingly, therefore, I kind of wanted a few more numbers.
Yes.
And in particular, there are two things that jumped out at me. One is you said, at the beginning, you said that, you know, the bottom quarter in this country, I think, spent 22% of their...
The bottom decile spent, yeah.
22% of their budget on food.
Yeah.
So that's a very partial equilibrium analysis.
Yeah.
Because as you know, trade theory has been known for over 100 years, trade policy changes not just prices, but also factor return, like wages, capital returns, and so on. So, and I know that people have done estimates of these things, so it'd be nice to have a fuller picture of the effect on real incomes, right? We don't want to know what the share of the budget is, we want to know what's the estimated impact on their real income.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a whole load of stuff that would be nice to have had there, so we had more of a sense of what's at stake.
Yeah.
And you mentioned kind of the first thing you mentioned on those similar lines is the first thing you mentioned about the economics of these trade deals didn't refer to the distributional analysis at all. You just talked about kind of productivity gains, but actually, you know, a very large amount of the economics of trade is precisely about who gains and who loses and through which routes. So it'd be nice to have a bit more of a picture of that. Later on, you gave numbers on the, when you're talking about global inequality, the countries that export a lot to the UK. And if you're talking about global inequality, then of course what matters is people rather than countries.
Yeah.
And Bangladesh, for instance, is, you know, 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more important, therefore, than Belize or Solomon Islands or, you know, several of the other islands you mentioned. Basically, it's got, you know, we're talking, you know, well over 100 million, 200 million people compared to a few hundred thousand. So, again, it'd be useful to just have those numbers there so we can see, you know, more what's at stake. That kind of leads to my more theoretical point, which is that in a lot of the discussion you talked about distribution within countries, but then when you talk about this idea of policy space, suddenly you have in mind a representative consumer or a representative agent, right? And you completely ignore the question of who it is that gets to decide the policy within that space. And that's why I asked the question about do these trade deals push labor standards up or down? You said, well, it's not relevant because it's about policy space, but it is relevant.
I think it is relevant.
If what you care about is, you know, people's welfare, it matters very much if policy space is being restricted in such a way that elites get to exploit the poor more or elites get to exploit the poor less. So I think that the whole question of policy space needs to be embedded within a much more sort of distributionally sensitive analysis, kind of political economy type analysis, who it is that gets to decide where you are in policy space.
Yeah, great. So I'll try to give some of the more of the details that you were asking for that kind of got left out of the presentation. So with respect to consumers of food within this country, there's a question of how much how much more would be spent, which is conditional on the basket of goods that are currently being consumed by people in different income deciles. And interestingly, or maybe not surprisingly, at the lowest deciles, there's a less of a reliance on imported food because fresh fruits and vegetables are not consumed as much. Those come from continental Europe. There's more of a reliance on grains and heavily processed food. So the sensitivity of the bottom decile specifically to the introduction of tariffs may be less than what's been estimated. So roughly, the suggestion is that for most consumers within this country, there's at stake 1 to 2% of their total household budget in food, which may be thought to be a lot, may not be, and that could easily be an effect that's swamped out by other economic effects from Brexit, which may be not even directly related to trade. There's been a suggestion that the poorest decile of this country would do better because they're no longer competing with immigrants for good jobs and so on. So there are a lot of intersecting effects that are not even necessarily purely about trade. And I've focused on Brexit in particular as an example because there's been a more concerted effort to try to estimate these gains and losses from different policy areas because it's something that's actively happening. But you could ask similar questions about what would happen if Trump made good on his threats to pull out of NAFTA, and there's been an effort to show that, in fact, it would be bad for the manufacturing industry and be bad for people who have jobs in manufacturing who Trump is trying to save. So I take the point that this is a much more dynamic analysis. I'll say a bit about why I think it's important to take the collective view about the value of policy space. It's in part to show that it's not a matter of the subjective valuation of a country. So it's not as if you could take an opinion poll in this country or another about the importance of growing one's own food from the perspective of a normal citizen or from the perspective of a farmer. What I want to say is that there's kind of a technical fact of the matter about how much would be lost if Britain no longer grew any of its food. And there's sort of a technical fact of the matter about what would be lost in terms of the competence and inclusiveness of the society. And it's the inclusiveness criteria that's meant to get at this distributional question that I think you rightly point out is important. But what I want to say that it's not a matter of asking people their views. It's something more objective than that. So that's helpful. Do you want to come back and say more?
Well, it wasn't about who's the, I was talking about there may be a technical fact of the matter about whether you should have food or not, but even that, whether you should produce your own food or not, but even that doesn't have much input necessarily into the decision-making process.
Right.
It's still a bunch of individuals who are in positions of institutional power who make those decisions. They're lobbied by a bunch of other people, and that's how decisions get made, generally speaking.
Yeah. That's generally why economists tend to want to exclude non-economic values, because it's thought that the political decision-making process is, as it is, overrun by special interest groups who will lobby for their own positions. So I kind of want to get away from that to try to say if we could take an impartial perspective, which may be impossible, and try to determine whether it actually is valuable for a society to grow its own food in order to have security against threats from other countries, or to have stability in terms of access to food for its poorest groups, that would be the right question to be asking, even though as a fact of the matter, it's completely true that the political decision-making process has input from disproportionately from elite groups.
Yeah. I was interested in your use of the expression policy space,
Yeah.
It suggests that there are different policies, and when you talk about an expansion of the policy space, that sounds, as from an economic point of view, can't be a bad thing. Of course, its value depends on how you might change. You might use the greater freedom, the greater degrees of freedom that you have in terms of instruments of policy that can be used to improve economic welfare, if you like. I'm not talking about distribution.
Yeah.
Okay. However, there's also a loss in policy space when, say, the UK leaves the EU.
Yeah.
And in purely numerical terms, the numbers of policies, bilateral deals with 180 countries, etc., may expand, but you've got to weigh that against the loss of policy space with, where even with the constraints of the EU, the value of that might be much higher than the value of the greater number of policies that can be implemented in a larger policy space when that larger policy space is simply characterized in terms of numbers of policies that are now becoming available.
Yeah.
So it's not, I think, clearly if it's one is a subset of the other, yeah, mm-hmm. one set of policies is a subset of another set of policies, that's likely to be worse. But in this case, when you're talking about leaving the EU, it's not that you've got an expansion of the set of policies, there's a contraction that's got to be weighed against the expansion.
Yeah.
And so the policy speaks, in putting a value to policy space, you've obviously got to work out what you can do with the policies that are now becoming available, the best that you can do. So what's the optimum in this new policy space compared to the old policy space? And that's how you would actually evaluate the value of the policy space in the two cases.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I mean, I think that's right, that what the EU is meant to offer is a pooling of sovereignty that expands the effective policy space of each country. It doesn't expand the formal policy space of each country. It expands the effective use of certain options. But what I think is specific to trade is that there isn't that potential for pooled sovereignty to work that way. So there is for other areas. I think there's international cooperation that's useful for thinking about immigration and other issues. But I don't see specifically to trade how there is an expansion of sovereignty. I think what there's an expansion of is the economic gains from trade through coordination and through regulation. But I take the broader point that outside the context of trade, there is in the EU and other instances of deep cooperation, there's an expansion of policy space rather than a contraction. I think just what's specific to trade is that what you get from cooperation is economic gains rather than gains in sovereignty.
Can I just add on that point of the, by the way, is it your concept, policy space, or is
no,
it,
no, okay. So it's a term that has much broader use. I think what's interesting is that in the context of trade, policy space is valued for developing countries, mm-hmm. because they're thought to need to be able to make use of options like to protect certain industries in order to grow. So the reason that policy space is thought to be of value ends up being cashed out, again, just in terms of economic prospects, and only for a limited set of countries. On my view, there is a non-economic value of policy space, and it's universal because all countries, regardless of their levels of development, have and value policy space.
No, that's great, that's very helpful, and I think you really sort of showed a purchase of the term in your presentation. I just wondered if the... So I think we can all see, and part of this entering the discussion already, how policy space is affected by membership of sort of these regional or mega-regional trade, you know, alliances, organizations, whatever you want to call them. But I'm just wondering to what extent it when we're talking about a bilateral mm-hmm. agreement, we can really talk about the loss of policy space or the policy choice to make certain compromises and arrangements, right? So is that the same concept of work, or do we need another term to describe these situations? And maybe in a way, the sort of the move toward bilateral trade agreements with both within the UK and within the US could be an expression of that need or the unwillingness to sort of yield in terms of policy space.
I think it works in the bilateral context, and I'll say even further, I think it works for thinking about unilateral trade liberalization as well. Yep. If there's a commitment to bind tariffs at certain rates for the foreseeable or a set period of time into the future, what it effectively does is take policy options off the table for that country, because that commitment needs to be seen as credible by investors, by firms, in order for there to be economic gains that come from that agreement. So I think any time that there's a kind of credible binding commitment not to pursue certain policy options, there's a loss of policy space. But I take the point that when there's actually a legal commitment that's difficult to extract oneself from, it's even more binding, and it's a greater loss of policy space in some sense.
Thanks very much. Really interesting presentation, set of questions. The UK government already announced that it's going to continue to offer all of the everything but arms beneficiary countries continue duty-free, tariff-free imports into the UK, plus a lot of the GSP countries. So the graph you showed, playing devil's advocate, far from being low on the list of priorities, actually UK government ministers have already been out to Pakistan and Bangladesh to guarantee to reassure their governments that there won't be any disruption. So when you talk about policy space, this is non-reciprocal, so in theory that allows these governments to do whatever they like as long as legislation doesn't contravene ILO conventions. So maximum policy space, unlimited imports of food and other products, garments obviously very important. When you talked about sort of further liberalisation of agricultural products, what more could be done? These are the 50, 60 poorest countries in the world, and there are no restrictions on them importing into the UK. Are you talking about country of origin rules, or is it the other next row of countries?
I think that's right, that both are at stake. So rules of origin could be simplified to make it easier for poor countries to make full use of the permissions, the formal permissions that are involved in GSP. It could also be expanded to more countries. I think the problem of Brexit is the uncertainty, which is really, on my understanding, the main problem for poor countries in making use of unilateral liberalization. Because, as I was just saying earlier, there is an agreement, a binding commitment, that is nevertheless less binding than in a more legally structured relationship. It's often difficult to know how credible the commitment is, and that credibility is necessary for countries as well as firms to make the greatest possible use of the benefits of trade liberalization. So there could be benefits or the potential for improvement through simplified administration of rules of origin. But I think the real problem is the bindingness of the commitment. I think it's still probably true that there remains significant uncertainty about what will actually happen. But I take your point that at least there's a verbal agreement to continue these programs.
Thanks for the interesting question. You mentioned at several points that in relation to different things, this is the right debate to be happening, or this bit of the debate can easily slip off the agenda, and so on, in relation to the global distributional inequality. I suppose what I'm wondering is, to what extent do you think that the UK government, that the political discourse and indeed the sort of policy administration level of knowledge and debate is kind of with you in some of this, mm-hmm. Where is it at, and what's the level of interaction between your academic work and perhaps that of other colleagues and policymakers within government and those that are advising them? Where do you think it's at, and what might move it on? Because clearly some of these questions that you're posing are very, very fundamental. I don't think the British public is thinking very much about, you know, what would it mean for the UK not to grow any of its own food or for manufacturing to collapse, whatever. and they're big questions. And it's sort of, do you feel that these nettles are being grasped? And what would it take to move those debates along, if not?
I think that's a really important question. I'm not sure I have a lot of insight on it. My suggestion is that we're moving towards the confrontation of these conflicts. I think in part because there's been a realization that many of the rosy economic forecasts of Brexit are not credible. And I think as those overly optimistic forecasts are kind of recede into the background of people's memory and awareness, there hopefully will be a confrontation of the likely costs. And that will raise the first question: how much is this society willing to pay? How much ought this society be willing to pay? And I think that's a very difficult question, particularly on the right, because it's meant to be the Tories are on the side of business. And if what they're doing is going to be bad for business, it will certainly be in their interest to obfuscate that and continue to obfuscate that for as long as possible. What we'd like to see is kind of labor making more of these economic costs. And I think there's been some encouraging signs of that. But I think, nevertheless, there is this ambivalence about trade liberalization on the left because it's not viewed as to the benefit of the least well-off or for the middle classes. So there's a reluctance to endorse policies or policy changes that may produce gains or losses for a group, the business elite, that are not really of interest to that. That party. So I don't think it's an accident that we are in this situation that trade liberalization and the idea of a better trade deal is underdeveloped and not part of political discourse. My hope is that as we get more information, these conflicts and values will be impossible to ignore.
And do you think say in the civil service, do you think that people sitting in DEFRA or Department of the EU and so on are grappling with this stuff and trying to advise ministers and so on?
I have no idea. I mean, I think it's viewed broadly as a good thing to have economic growth, and I think there needs to be something more sophisticated said about it, which is how much we value that in relation to other things that it's in conflict with. I mean, certainly there's been a more sophisticated debate for a long time about how much, in terms of economic prosperity, a society is willing to give up to ensure that there are good jobs. So hopefully showing how trade is part of that more established conversation would be helpful.
Kind of following that same token, along the five capitals approach, so if we look at it not just from a financial capital standpoint, but from, you know, human capital, social capital, I'm curious, are there any precedents that are set already, maybe from, say, Norway or Iceland or any nation I'm unaware of, with regard to government policy that kind of takes a checks and balances approach to trade, such as we see this as a financial gain somehow, but we're going to protect our social capital, our human capital through this means or that means, so that way it doesn't say that, you know, the porch doesn't get too hot with regard to making lots of financial capital for, you know, both the UK and US, but yet our social and human capital start waning.
I don't have an answer to that yet. I would like to know more about the Norway model of relations with the EU and how that's justified, because I mean, it seems to me that's just strictly a bad deal. So why is that? Why is that viewed as a good deal from within that country? I mean, what forms of sovereignty are retained such that those policy areas, I think agriculture is one of them, and fishing is another. Why are those viewed as so important that the greater economic gains to be had from no longer having border checks are viewed as worth paying? I would like to know more about that.
It could be suggested that indeed some of those things that are retained have to do with identity and are valued more than some of the more narrow economic or even sort of policy space dimensions of it, right?
Yeah, I know certainly in the American context, and agriculture is part of this romantic ideal of what the nation is about. So
yeah.
I mean,
fishery in Norway, I'm assuming is equally strong.
Yeah.
I could partially answer that if I might.
Yeah, please.
I'm Norwegian. Norway is so rich that, it doesn't really, what's most important and what sits in most Norwegian minds is that the Nazis invaded us in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So security and our connection to NATO is primary. The certain, as you were starting to say, there are certain cultural values that play in there, and since we can pay for it anyway, okay.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that there could be a self-conception of a society that we're rich enough. It's strange from an American perspective, but I think that's a completely legitimate view.
I mean, if we get more money, why spend it on yourself? We want a society that's going to try and take care of most people.
I just wonder, I mean, another example of that would be Swiss payments to farmers, which is very much on that side, like we're rich enough to afford this. But I was just thinking on the discussion about policy space, I think there is an inherent, trying to come up with like a politically neutral definition of policy space is, I think it's impossible. And I think you could go back a variety of levels. The most fundamental level would be just positive and negative liberty and that debate as I have learned. And then tracing that through, you come to this debate around the new institutional economics, around are institutions just constraining or are they facilitative?
Yeah.
And that's kind of saying at the national level, are we just thinking in terms of negative liberty or is it about laws that allow us to do something? And then you just get to this kind of broad left and right divide on regulation as empowering versus regulation as constraining. And I think that came out most clearly when you said maybe the hard Brexiteers just really want policy space. And I thought, no, they just want to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. It's almost impossible to come up with a politically neutral sense of, what does it mean for a government to be free? Because it either depends if you think that essentially the government should be limiting the market, or essentially the government should be facilitating the market and stepping back. And I think I don't know if there's a way to really reconcile those.
I've previously done work on this question of sovereignty and policy space in a different context. So there's a paper called Democracy Enhancing Multilateralism by Bob Cohen, Steve Macedo, and Annie Moravcik. I've been part of that. And I think it's right that it's not going to be neutral. So the way they talk about it is in terms of the value of democracy. So being an effective democracy, they cash out in terms of liberalism. So the importance of protecting certain rights, treating people as democratic equals, having deliberation. And what I've supplied instead is, I think, the maybe broader idea of inclusiveness as replacement for democracy. And competency, which I think is, which denotes security, but other issues of just the functioning, the satisfactory functioning of societies independently of their justice. So I don't suggest that those ideas are completely neutral, but I think they provide a very broad framework for debates about the importance of particular policy areas for instantiating those two values very broadly understood. I mean, I take the point that neutrality is impossible. I agree with that. But I think, nevertheless, you can have a very general concept that allows for a lot of, that houses a lot of political debates within it.
You want to follow up? Just a little follow up on the previous thing. So maybe the Norwegians feel they're rich enough not to worry about it. I just note that, of course, Norway is one of the most equal countries in the world as well. So I think you're probably right about this feeling rich, but it's not a question of per capita GDP. It's because the vast majority of the population have a perfectly decent standard of living.
Yeah.
So, you know, a majority probably don't feel like they're scrambling for those last pennies. In contrast, in the US, as
yeah.
you will know very well, the wages of the majority have stagnated for 45 years now.
Yeah.
And so clearly the majority have very good reason to clutch at whatever, however fantastical it is, however, whatever a phantom it may be, clutch at the possibility of doing something that will get them a bit more income.
I think it's exactly right that domestic inequality makes it very difficult for a society to be satisfied in that respect. Yeah.
Let's just take two or three more questions, then we need to end. So you got a question? Any other questions? You had one more question, right?
I've already asked.
Yeah, okay.
It's just a comment, actually, as a response to, as an example. I don't know if everyone here knows it, maybe most of you do, some don't. This discussion that took place, I think, last year in relation to the EU-Canada trade agreement, and there was Belgium, right, who blocked it for some time. And why? Because they wanted to include environmental standards as a precondition for, let's say, you know, the renewal of the treaty or its continuation, right? And it's really interesting how to really consider the public reception or the debate of this, conflict from the point of view of the policy space.
Mm.
So it's really, and to think about Brexit or what will happen to the UK in relation to the EU and its potential in terms of influencing trade agreements or not, from this point of view. So it's much more complicated, and I think it's really important to say that belonging to pooling sovereignty may also mean that in fact your ability to influence trade agreements may also be much wider.
I've left out environmental standards from the analysis, and I find it difficult to see how it would be included in either competency or inclusiveness, but I do sort of see that as a problem that I haven't yet resolved. Yeah.
Well, it gets to your point about how the environment is certainly one of those issues which can only be addressed in sort of a bilateral, multilateral context,
yeah.
right? So it doesn't really fall within the nation's policy sphere in the first place.
That's
I guess
true.
You could argue,
yeah.
If you take that perspective. Anyway, so I forgot one announcement. So. We don't just offer food, free food and food for thought, but we also offer points for people who are participating in what's called the Continuous Professional Development Program. So if you're here and you're interested in that, we've been certified our seminar, so we can on a weekly basis give points to attendees. If you're interested in that, please see Billy, who's a specialist on this this topic, or send us an email. Anyway, with that, please join me in thanking Sarah.
Thanks so much for your question.